Morning, everyone. This is Michael Gibbons appearing in the Supreme Court courtroom in Carson City. I'm joined by Judges Jerry Tao and Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. Can counsel hear me okay?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Andrew Osiski for George Pounds.
Yes, Your Honor. Karen Basher on behalf of the defendant.
All right. Good morning. Thank you both for appearing today with our special electronic presentation. We've been doing this since May. It's worked out pretty well. If there is any problem, we'll just pause until we've worked out the problem. If somehow we lose the video and the audio, we will have to go to telephone. Unfortunately, that's only happened once in all of our arguments, but we're ready for it. We appreciate, again, you being here this morning. It's our second case of the day. Judge Tao, do you have anything you want to say before we get started?
Just to echo what Judge Gibbons said, thank you for working with our IT guys to get this set up. I guess this is the new normal, and it's probably going to, you know, based on the pace of the vaccinations, be the way we do things for the next several months at least. If there are any technical difficulties, like, you know, one of us blanks out or anything, you know, feel free to, you know, wave your hand or something like that to let us know. We've had it. It's been working pretty well. We've had a couple glitches depending on internet connectivity, but you know, we'll do our best to work with everybody, and hopefully you'll be patient with us as well. This is just the world we're in now, but thank you, and we're looking forward to the argument.
Judge Bulla?
Good morning. Thank you both for being here. As you can see, Judge Tao and I are both in the Las Vegas courtroom with our masks on. We will try to talk as clearly as we can. If you cannot understand us, please let us know, and we'll be happy to repeat the question. Thank you, and we're looking forward to hearing your argument.
Okay. This is case number 77520-COA, George Paz versus Rent-A-Center. This is the time set for the oral argument. We have Mr. Wasilewski representing the appellant. And would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, I would.
How much?
Five minutes should be fine, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right. there are potentially a lot of issues you can discuss in your opening statement here. You might find that 5 minutes was too much. If you go over, that's fine. You'll just have whatever's left over at that point.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is Andrew Osiewski appearing for George Paz. There's four questions in the appeal. Is it an error to exclude Dr. Kazmiri from testifying? Is it error in admitting prior accidents and injuries that some are more than 20 years old? Is it misconduct warranting a new trial as to what the defense counsel said and did during the trial? And is the jury making a word of no future medicals justifying a new trial? Kazmiri, it is our position that he was a critical component in the case. He authored an expert witness report. He was the treating physician since fall of 2015. He stated there was no prior pain or problems. All the pain or problems that Mr. Paz had were due to the accident. He was unable to work after the accident, and he's still unable to work. He would require future care. There was an amount that was requested in the future calculation of medicals. However, there was no future medical provision allowed by the jury. In August of 2016, there was a movement by the defense to exclude Dr. Kazmiri in a motion in limine. This motion was argued thoroughly and was denied. This establishes that the defense had an opportunity to understand that Mr. Kazmiri would be inclined and would be called upon to testify at the trial. So we believe that there was no prejudice in having had allowed Mr. Kazmiri to testify, but he was precluded by the trial judge from being allowed to do so. We believe that attorney misconduct can be considered harmless error. However, for a new trial to be awarded, the jury needs to have evinced that they were controlled by emotions and symptoms. And in this case, we believe that the jury was so moved. The jury found for less than the special medical damages that were spent on behalf of Mr. Paz, no future medicals. The jury made no award of pain and suffering, and there was evidence that alternative causation came into the trial that was brought in not by an expert witness. We believe that the only appropriate standard for excluding evidence that was inadvertently not disclosed in a pretrial memo would be EDCR 2.67. EDR 2.67 does not allow for a preemptive sanction, only if there was non-disclosure that was present. In this case, disclosure was in fact present. Disclosure was made on numerous occasions. Disclosure was also listed on the defense pretrial side of the pretrial memo. It was argued to not be included in the trial in August of 2016. But nonetheless, in one pretrial non-disclosure that was soon thereafter rectified in February 8th of 2017, there was one part that was left out of the pretrial memo that was re-included after 46 days before trial started. We believe that that satisfies the requirement in EDCR 2.67 that disclosure was made 15 days before trial, and in 16.1 that disclosure was made 30 days. We have also determined that if there are items that are excluded from the list that was never disclosed, that would be grounds to exclude that from the testimony. And I have found no case to the contrary where an item was included in the list but then was excluded from trial. I don't have any record of any case in Nevada that makes that ruling based on EDCR 2.67. Witness testimony, even in violation of the witness exclusion rule, needs to be balanced with relevance, pertinence, and the detailed matters with which the testimony is required to be explained to the jury. In this case, we have testimony that came in from the expert witnesses that state that there was causation. While there was causation from the accident, they implied that there was causation that was prior to the accident, but was not actually admitted. Testified to by the expert witnesses for the defense. Rather, that was argument that was made by counsel for the defendant. We've objected to that numerous times at trial, I believe 6 or 7 times, and persistently the resulting conclusion from the trial judge was that was admissible not with an admonition, but with a caution to the jury that it was to disregard it. We believe that was an error, that it should have been in an admonition at the minimum or some other type of sanction, but those sanctions were not present in this case whatsoever.
Mr. Wasilewski, did you move for a mistrial after
no,
that
Honor,
occurred?
We did not.
Was
move
there
for
a reason for that?
As Your Honor may know, I'm the 10th attorney that's handled this file. I came in after the initial brief was made and after the answering brief was made by the defendant, Your Honor. My read on this case was that Lehrer would apply to that very question, and that was the case that the defense used. Lehrer stands for the idea that you need to ask for a new trial if there's conflicting jury verdicts. In this case, there were no such conflicting jury verdicts. Judge Givens ruled in that case that if there are conflicting jury verdicts, to move the case along, ask for a new trial then while the jury is still pending or pondering their verdict. In this case, there wasn't such a thing. And even if there was, NRS 34.240 states that the motion for a new trial is discretionary on behalf of the plaintiff. There isn't a requirement in NRS 34240 that says that you have to ask for a new trial prior to making your appeal. And furthermore, the appeals rules state that there is no preclusion for filing an appeal just because you haven't made a new trial pursuant to NRCP 5059 or NRS 34.240. So I believe that Lehrer stands for a very unique situation, Your Honor, and that situation just isn't present here. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Your Honor. There are other problems with
Mr. Wasilewski.
Yes.
The related question here, how do you address that in terms of not asking for additor below?
So my understanding of why additor wasn't requested was because that the appeal would suffice based on the applicable reading of counsel at the time. Lehrer is the controlling precedent. Lehrer stands for something that wasn't present here. An editor wasn't necessary. An appeal would have been just fine. That's the way I understand what happened at the post-trial process.
But in both of those situations, doesn't it make sense that the trial judge would be the one that best equipped to address this in the first instance, since she heard the evidence and knows exactly what the situation is? Same thing with the misconduct. I mean, all of these situations are much better addressed in the first instance, have a record made, and you and us wouldn't be in the position we're in now. We're kind of guessing as to what the effect of these various things are.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree completely with that assertion. And that's why in my reply, I chose to characterize this as mostly abuse of discretion by the trial judge, in that she made a snap judgment to exclude the doctor's testimony solely on violation of EDCR 2.67, perhaps knowing that there is no such precedent out there, or maybe she did not know. However, I know Judge Bell. I know how thorough she is. I know she had a reluctance to address any kind of further sanction against the defendant. She said so numerous times in the record. It appears to me that it's likely that the plaintiff's attorneys, who are very seasoned attorneys, I may add, thought that such a motion would be futile before the trial, and they just decided to bring it.
So, I mean, here's the counter argument. Again, not talking about this case, but this is sort of the larger issue that we're grappling with. The advantage, and I think, you know, you guys alluded to this a little bit, the advantage to having, if there were a rule that you have to file a motion for new trial or a motion for editor first before you file an appeal, the advantage you get is, number one, as Judge Gibbons pointed out, the trial judge knows a lot better what happened than we do. But secondly, the standard review doesn't kick in. The trial judge can just do it. He or she can just grant a new trial based on what they observe. But we don't get to do that. Our review is abuse of discretion, which is a lot more deferential. In other words, even if we think the trial court was wrong, we frequently have to affirm it. And you, as the plaintiff's attorney, you can get around that standard of review by filing that motion, and that would be a policy reason why we would want these motions filed. The second policy reason is, you know, everybody thinks an objection is just to preserve things for appeal, and that's only one of the two reasons to even object to trial. The second reason to object to trial is the trial judge can fix it so there's no appeal. And I know that's not, you know, and so those are what I see as a counter argument to what you're saying, and why there, you know, those would be arguments in favor of a rule that if you don't file this motion first, then you don't get to appeal from it because you didn't give the trial judge a chance to fix this stuff, and then you have the whole standard review issue. What are your thoughts on that?
Your Honor, I agree with you that this is not the most efficient way to handle this kind of a case. I have no idea whether or not there was somewhat of a fatigue that set in over the 14 or 17 days. I don't know if there was a futility, apprehensive of some kind of a futileness that would have precluded somebody from making that request. I really don't know. I just know that the rule says that a new trial is a discretionary thing on behalf of the plaintiff's attorneys. There is a specific rule that says that if there is such a trial, it should be done in 5 days. If there is a second trial and that second trial results in this exact same verdict, you can't do a third one. And that would tend to preclude an appeal. And so while I agree that efficiency would be better, the legislature has given us clear guidance, and that guidance is discretionary with the plaintiff's attorney. So while I appreciate that better ways could have been done to handle this, I don't think that precludes the appeal at all. And I do believe that EDCR 2.67 controls and precluding Judge Bell from actually working to stop Dr. Kesmari from testifying in the way that plaintiff's counsel wanted him to testify.
Mr. Wasilewski, let me ask you this question. The purpose of having Dr. Kesmari testify in part was for future damages. Is that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And future damages were not awarded by the jury in this case, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it would be difficult to add additor to this particular situation because future damages weren't given at all. Because the testimony wasn't available, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the problem on the damages.
Yes, Your Honor. When you have a complete absence of future damages and you have no testimony that would allow anything to come in regarding the future damages, while it would be more efficient to have a new trial based on that, it appears that the best course of action is what happened. Despite the fact that efficiency is not necessarily maintained.
Well, Mr. Wasilewski,
yes, Your Honor.
Didn't counsel for the plaintiffs argue for future damages in closing argument and use the other evidence they came in, even though they didn't have the particular doctor they wanted? There was other evidence, so they argued for it.
My understanding is that since Dr. Kesmari was the treating physician, Dr. Kesmari was going to be able to tie everything together. During the polling of the jury, plaintiff's counsel determined that there was an evidence of jury fatigue and such that the jury had glossed over the specific facts of the case because the facts were just too numerous and there wasn't anyone to bring it together. So if you were going to have a new trial or you were going to have some kind of an editor motion based on a complete lack of tying things together and a paucity of future medical damages testimony and an already confirmed reluctance to award even $1 of future medical damages, then it seems like the best course of action would be the lesser efficient course, which would be to just take it on appeal, argue the facts, argue the law before Your Honor and this panel, take it back, and then do it again. And I think that's what we're doing here.
Okay. All right, Mr. Wasilewski, you were at 5 minutes, and then the court started asking questions. So there went your 5 minutes. So we'll give you 1 minute as it stands right now for a rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll return to the respondent side of it, and we have Ms. Karen Bashor. How do you pronounce your last name?
Dasher, Your Honor.
Dasher. All right. All right, Ms. Dasher, I hope you're not the 10th counsel on the case.
No, I am not. Maybe second or third on this side.
Okay. All right. Well, Mr. Wasilewski did a good job putting the record together, and we are looking forward to hearing from you, too. All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I think the court has really hit on the biggest issue and the biggest hurdle that the appellant is facing with respect to the challenges now raised on appeal, and that is the procedural hurdle by the failure by counsel for the appellant below to move for a new trial before the jury was discharged so that the court in the first instance could review this issue, whether a new trial was warranted or even whether to send back the jury for further deliberations. This is a case where the appellant is seeking a proverbial second bite at the apple. And under Nevada law, that simply cannot be allowed here under the record and under the law. As the United States Supreme Court set forth in Unitherm, and as all of you have hit on the nose with your questions, it is really the trial court judge that must in the first instance review this issue by knowing, by sitting through the trial, by seeing the witnesses, hearing from the witnesses, and the transcript itself cannot relay what happened below. And Judge Bellamy has been on this case longer than all of us today, and this was a 12-day jury trial. The jurors had deliberated thoughtfully for 2 days before coming to arrive at its verdict, and the Nevada law and our jurisprudence has a very strong deference not only to the trial court below, but to the jury and the jury's verdict. And I think that the appellant has a very difficult hurdle, both procedurally and substantively, to argue that a new trial should be granted in this instance. Number one is the issue of waiver, which we've already addressed, and number two, on the merits. With respect to the merits, appellant likes to would now claim that the verdict, even though it was not challenged below, either before the jury was dismissed or by virtue of a motion for new trial, appellant now claimed that the jury verdict was inconsistent and inadequate. And in fact, to try to address the issue of waiver, appellant points to the issue or points to the case of Lehrer. And I think it's important here that, first of all, there is a deference to the trial court and to the jury. And with that deference, it is only that you set aside the jury verdict if you find that there was inconsistency in the verdict and that the jury could not arrive at that verdict by applying the proper jury instructions. And with Lehrer, the court finds essentially like a plain error standard and says that, well, if Judge Bell saw by reviewing the jury verdict that there was an inconsistency in reviewing how the jury had responded to the various questions, then she could have and possibly should have done something about it. And Chief Judge Bell, given her experience, given her sitting through the entire trial and given her experience with the entire record below, I'm sure would have done something if she found that there was any inconsistency. Simply put, there were no inconsistencies whatsoever. The jury's verdict was perfectly consistent with the evidence below. It is actually perfectly consistent with the law that we have with respect to Quintero. That is on point in that the Nevada Supreme Court even upheld a jury finding fault with the defendant but not awarding any damages whatsoever. With respect to the Snover case, it is an Illinois case, but Illinois follows the jurisprudence that Nevada does with respect to following the deference to the trial court and to the jury. And even there, the court upheld that because it was supported by the record, a jury could, within its discretion, find medical expenses to be awarded to the plaintiff, but no pain and suffering. And in its analysis, the court reasoned that it was based upon the fact that there was evidence where there was some conflicting evidence about objective and subjective complaints, which is the fact in our case. And there was also references, the court actually indicated that diminished pain is not inconsistent with an award of pain of pain-related meds. So in our case, with respect to cause, there is essentially a litany of evidence to support why the jury found that there may have been pain-related medical expenses that would be attributable and to be awarded to Mr. Paz, but also support a finding that did not find him permanently injured or to the amount of pain that he had claimed. Simply put, there was evidence in the record by the officers who had testified that they had observed what they characterized to be minor damage. Pictures, which are worth a thousand words, were presented to the jury showing the back of the PT Cruiser that Mr. Paz was in at the time of the incident, showing virtually no damage whatsoever. More importantly, the jury, through 12 days of trial, got to see and observe Mr. Paz. Through 12 days of trial, got to see and observe the testimony of his doctors, and also to see and observe the testimony of the defense witnesses. And they saw that Mr. Paz was not forthright with his providers. Mr. Paz was not forthright with the jury. He admitted to telling white lies on the stand. He was inconsistent about how he was reacting to the pain medication. He was essentially living his life like normal, consistent with the defense theories of the case, because he was able to go to work. He was able to go vacation with his family. He was able to father a child naturally, even though he specifically told the jury that he couldn't engage in such relations. The jury, who has the sole responsibility to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses, got to evaluate those witnesses, and based upon Mr. Paz alone, even on top of everything else, had a verdict that was perfectly consistent and adequate. And so we believe that that is not a basis for a new trial in this matter, and that is supported by the case law and the record below. With respect to Dr. Kosemary, again, the issue here is that the appellant is raising...
Ms. Basher, before you switch to him, and we definitely want to hear your argument on that, but back to sort of wrap up the last section and the facts and the procedural argument. Is there any merit to the claim that appellant's counsel made during his argument that if we apply NRS 34.240, that a motion did not need to be filed in the trial court before raising this issue on appeal about a new trial? And also, if you look at the Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure and apply those, then again, same thing, don't have to file the motion below, we can proceed. And so he interprets that to say he can go ahead and argue everything related to his motion for new trial and editor as if it had been made below. It's not necessary. That's essentially the point he's making. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. First and foremost, that's an issue that's raised for the first time here at oral argument. It wasn't raised at all before right now. And second of all, I think based upon a reading of the case law that's controlling in Nevada and the United States Supreme Court, it is required that the motion for new trial be filed in the first instant, except for cases of plain error, and that essentially because of the reasons that we have so much deference to the trial court and to the jury, that we have to have that as a preliminary hurdle before anything can any jury verdict is overturned. Essentially, I think it's unfair to this court to ask that a 12-day trial be overturned and a jury's 2-day deliberation be overturned without having the trial court.
What about editor, if the jury did not award any pain and suffering or future meds, could editor have been requested below, and is that what they should have done, or can we still look at it here?
I think it could have been requested below. I think it would still be an issue. There was evidence in the record presented to the jury for them to consider. It kind of overlaps with the issue with Dr. Cosemary. The jury was still able to consider damages, future damages, but the jury, within its discretion, chose to believe the credible evidence and did not believe that future damages was awarded. So it could have been requested, but I think it would be an issue below as to whether that could be a viable remedy in this particular instance.
Okay, and then you were going to turn to Dr. Kazmary. We're very interested in talking about whether the district court abused its discretion in excluding that testimony, and assuming for the moment it was improperly excluded, if you could also address what other evidence was there that the appellant plaintiff was able to present on the future damages, and so were they still able to argue their theory of the case, or was there substantial prejudice because the doctor was excluded?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I appreciate those concerns. And it is our contention, Your Honor, that there was no abuse of discretion. Chief Judge Bell was within her discretion to eliminate or exclude Dr. Cosemary's testimony. And I'll use that keyword testimony from trial based upon EDCR 2.67 and 2.69. Now, again, for the first time, appellant counsel raises the issue that it wasn't proper under EDCR 2.67. During the briefing, there was references that the sanction was only, the court could only exercise its sanction based upon Rule 37, its inherent authority, but that's not the case. We know, actually, contrary to what counsel indicated, that there is case law indicating that Chief Judge Bell's ruling was consistent with the case law. Unfortunate, there was an omission of a trial exhibit, and below there was at least argument that his name was just inadvertently omitted, and there, even without going through a prejudice analysis, the court upheld that exclusion. In console, pursuant to EDCR 2.67, there was an exclusion of the witness, and again that was upheld. And what's important is that yes, the plaintiff was still able to argue the theory of the case, was still able to get in the information that they wanted from Dr. Cosemary. There were records by Dr. Cosemary that were admitted into evidence. There were physicians who testified that they reviewed the records of Dr. Cosemary, that they agreed with Dr. Cosemary, and that, like Dr. Cosemary, there was evidence of future damages for pain and suffering that the plaintiff contended should be attributable and should be awarded in this case. And so, and just to be specific with respect to Dr. Burkhead, Dr. Kidwell, and even Dr. Dunn, all these physicians, there was a parade of doctors in support of plaintiff's case, and they all were able to get in the information that Dr. Closemary was would have been able to testify to as well. So despite these conclusionary allegations that Dr. Closemary was so critical and...
Ms. Basher, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let me ask you a question. The doctor was actually excluded about 8 months prior to the case actually going to trial. Is that right?
From the trial actually moving forward, yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay. During that period of time, did the respondents have available to them a report by Dr. Closemary?
Yes, Your Honor.
He actually do a report? Was it disclosed as part of the expert witness disclosures under NRCP 16.1?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that was disclosed prior to him not being properly identified in the 2.67 pretrial memorandum?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so what was the prejudice to your client in not properly identifying him in the 2.67 memorandum, pretrial memorandum, if he was known to the clients in advance, all his opinions had been properly disclosed pursuant to 16.1? Where was the prejudice?
The prejudice, Your Honor, and I'll just comment on the fact that Judge Bell did address the prejudice issue as well, and based upon repeated violations of the court's orders, found the exclusion warranted in this case. And the prejudice was with respect to trial strategy. And as Judge Bell commented and basically what was going through our minds as well, is that you can disclose a witness based upon 16.1. They can be deposed, they can be listed, but if they're not listed timely under pretrial disclosure, the other side has a right to rely and to their detriment as to whether that witness is going to take the stand at trial. And that may impact rebuttal witnesses, that may impact theory of the case, it may impact numerous things. And so, therefore, we had a right to rely on what was disclosed or not disclosed and timely. And even though, you know, it was, like you said, you know, well in advance of the trial actually moving forward, there were 7 trial settings. It was very difficult to figure out strategy with this moving target. And, you know, thankfully, the judge finally put down the gauntlet and, you know, made some sort of predictability. And I'll just note for the record, because I don't think it's commented anywhere else, that with Dr. Closemary, it wasn't just a flippant decision by Judge Bell. It was a thoughtful decision. It was on the record, and the plaintiff even, you know, filed a motion to reconsider, which Judge Bell denied. So I think that based upon the repeated violations of the court orders, that Judge Bell's exclusionary ruling was proper in this instance, Your Honor. And just really quick, with respect to the mistrial, with respect to the misconduct, we don't believe that under any of the relevant standards that there was no way in which the jury verdict was affected in a substantial way that would have changed things to the detriment of the plaintiff. There was no way that the jury was harmed by any claimed misconduct. There was no misconduct. It was all appropriate, and that the jury's verdict would have been the same regardless. And so we ask that the court uphold this 12-day jury trial, 2-day deliberation, and allow the verdict to stand.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Basher. And that concludes for the respondents. We'll go back to the appellant. And hold on, Mr. Wazlewski, you have 1 minute. You were at about 30 seconds, so we're putting it at a minute now.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in my conclusion, Your Honor, I would just like to say that no one doubts the sincerity of Judge Bell and how she ruled to exclude Dr. Casmore. But the issue is, and no one's saying that if there is a non-disclosure, EDCR 2.67 doesn't operate to allow a sanction at the discretion of the trial court. What we are saying, however, there was not a non-disclosure. There was a disclosure. the disclosure occurred, it occurred timely, and that precludes any type of sanction underneath EDCR 2.67, which is exactly what Judge Bell said that she was sanctioning the conduct regarding. You have to be bound by the law and the jurisdiction. No matter how sincere it is that you want to sanction the party for whatever conduct, you have to be bound. And if EDCR's 2.67 is relied upon, that reliance requires you to not sanction for a disclosure. That was timely. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wasluski. Then that concludes the argument for today. The court will take this matter under submission. We again thank both counsel for your excellent work on this case. Really good. And the arguments were quite helpful. Whether we can consider new arguments is a different question, but the arguments are very helpful. So we will look at everything and decide how we're going to use this information from today. And Judge Tao or Judge Bola, do you have anything further that you want to say?
No, other than thank you both for your argument. This is this case raises some pretty interesting, aside from the facts, some potentially interesting legal issues that we're going to thoroughly chew on. And really appreciate the argument. And you'll have a decision in the near future.
Thank you both for excellent arguments. It was very helpful, and we sure appreciate you participating via our audio visual means right now, our video conferencing means. It has been challenging, and I know it's been challenging for you all too. And we just really appreciate your participation today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.